Today's conversation is a very special one for me, both professionally and personally. My guest is someone who has shaped the field of negotiation in one of the most intense environments imaginable. He's the former chief of the FBI's Crisis Negotiation Unit, a man who has spent decades negotiating when lives were literally on the line. Gary Nesner is widely regarded as one of the world's leading experts in hostage and crisis negotiation. He has been involved in some of the most challenging and high-stakes situations in modern history and helped define what effective negotiation truly means under extreme pressure. And in his bestseller, Stalling for Time, he shares his hard-won insights with us. But beyond all titles and achievements, what stands out most is his deep understanding of human behavior, emotion, and connection. I had the privilege of learning from Gary personally during an intensive training over two remarkable days, an experience that profoundly shaped the way I think about negotiation, communication, and trust. In today's episode, we will explore what it really takes to negotiate when everything is at stake, how the FBI approach differs from more traditional models like Harvard, and what all of us, leaders, negotiators, and human beings can learn from these powerful principles. Gary, it's truly an honor to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you today, Christian.
Thank you. So, let's say something to your person. Gary, what originally drew you into the world of hostage negotiation?
Yeah, I wanted to be an FBI agent since I was a young kid. And then when I got my initial training, the specialty of negotiations was just emerging. And I was attending a lecture in which they were discussing new innovative training programs the FBI was engaged in. And one of those was hostage negotiation, which the FBI had just copied in its original basic form from the New York City Police Department. And hearing about the process of diffusing tense situations with communication skills was very appealing to me, and something that I thought would fit my personality and my natural instincts. And it immediately became a goal of mine. And after a few years, I was able to secure training in the program. And then later in my career, it became not just a part-time function, but a full-time function. And then I spent the last 10 years of my career as the chief negotiator for the FBI.
Mm-hmm. Was there a specific moment in your career that fundamentally changed you as a person?
Well, that's hard to say. I think it's more of a evolutionary process. I think every incident you work, you learn, and you learn from others. A colleague of mine always used to say that if you want to be a good negotiator, you have to become a student of the game. You don't attend one course or read one book and say, okay, now I know everything. You have to constantly seek knowledge and experience. And I've always said you should learn from everyone you can every time you can. Now, there's different emphasis placed on aspects of negotiations by different instructors. My view is take it in, listen to it. Does this feel comfortable to you? Does it fit you? Do you think, does it resonate with you? And then from that, you form your sort of approach to negotiations. I think one of the big impacts, maybe the biggest impact on me after I'd been negotiating for over 10 years, I met Dr. Mike Webster from Canada, a psychologist, and we had active listening skills as a small part of our FBI curriculum at that time, but he explained them and taught them at a level I'd never seen before. And that approach did have a profound effect on me and helped me reach a decision some years later to focus the entire FBI program on those crisis intervention relationship building tools.
Mm-hmm. And funny is, he's a very, very big, strong man, and he talks about active listening.
Yeah, he was a former football player, college football player, professional football player, and a professional wrestler. But he's a gentle soul, and he has a very unique way of communicating with people, and he's instantly your best friend. I've never seen anyone quite so adept at it and effective. And I think, you know, while I had some of those attributes, I think being around him and bringing him to every course we taught at the Academy, the FBI Academy, to help us deliver this material. I mean, it certainly had an effect on me and, fine-tuning my sense of understanding that people want to work with people that they respect and like.
Mm-hmm.
So all the business negotiation courses in the world talk a great deal about structure and procedure and process and things you say, how you say it, when you say it. And all of that is good and helpful information, and I don't criticize any of it. But at the end of the day, it's really the relationship you create with the person, whether it's in a business context or a crisis situation or dealing with your spouse or your children or, you know, a friend that's having a difficult time. I think if we are empathic and, genuine and sincere and engaging, I think that's the secret formula for success in negotiations.
Yeah, true. And you can learn empathy. That's one
yes.
of the greatest things. A friend of us, Andreas, and me are mimic resonance, so mimic expressions master trainer. And it's so cool to see that you can learn to see what happens in other persons, what they feel.
Yeah.
And that's very great to know you can learn empathy.
Yeah, I think a lot of business negotiations are very focused on this is what I want.
Mm.
This is how I'm going to present my argument, my proposal. And if I do this the right way and I respond the right way, I'm more likely to get success. And again, I don't denigrate any of that. I think that's all useful and valuable information. But for me, it's how you come across and the relationship you build. I think everything in life is about relationships. You know, I know you heard me say this in the class where you attended, but of all the situations I worked through the years, we would always ask the person who surrendered in very tense, violent situations where life was on the line, would ask them, what did I say that made you come out peacefully? Because we want to know, obviously, as people that do this for a living, we want to replicate what we do well. And if there's mistakes that have been identified, then we want to avoid those in the future. But the response we consistently got almost every time was a surprising one, but extremely insightful. And it was that, I don't remember what you said, but I like the way you said it. And if you think about that, that's really powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, because I think if my one criticism of business negotiations, I think there's more of an emphasis on how you say it.
Mm-hmm.
What you say, excuse me. There's more emphasis on what you say. And my emphasis is always how you say it, how you come across, how you're perceived. Does the other person look to me as being cooperative, flexible, a nice person, likable, someone they want to work with? If you ask me, that's essentially the keys to the success that I had through my career. And I think particularly so in the context of law enforcement, because we're truly in a crisis. In business, you're both going in, the other party and you are going into the discussion, both hoping to come to an agreement. In law enforcement, the other party is resisting and they don't want to comply. They don't want to surrender or give up, let the hostage go, whatever it might be. So if we speak to them in a genuine, respectful way, they don't expect that from police. It sort of disarms them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And they ultimately reach the decision to cooperate because they said, I like the way Gary talked to me. He seemed like he was honest. He wasn't lying to me. You know, I think when I asked him for advice, he gave me good advice about what I should do. I mean, it's a really simple thing in many ways, Christian, but it's hard for people to understand and embrace it.
Yes. Yeah, true. In Germany, we say, der Ton macht die Musik. Sound makes the music.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
That's something like that. And if you are calm to someone, he gets more in resonance with you.
Yeah. And I also think, I don't mean this as a negative, but I think, and I'm of Austrian-German heritage, I think that heritage is very organized, can be very official, can be very focused on the next step, the next point, the next achievement, the next goal. And that's what makes German people very industrious and productive and successful. But in negotiations, I think it's helpful, particularly in the German-speaking world, to try to move into a little bit of a softer approach, a little bit of, in other words, take your time. We always say, have always said for 40 years in the FBI, we have to earn the right to be of influence. People don't say, oh, Gary Noesner with the FBI is here, I'm going to surrender now. It doesn't usually work that way. I have to, through my communication efforts, through the exchanges, my inquiries about how they're doing, what the problem is, showing that I understand it, you know, this empowers me to be of influence later on. And so you get there, you have to take your time. You know, the business guru, Stephen Covey from the United States, he described this in a nice way. He said, first, seek to understand, and then seek to be understood. Mm-hmm. So before we lay out our objectives and our proposals, if we're able to be patient and thoughtful and listen to what the other party is saying and what they're trying to achieve, and demonstrating that we understand it by repeating it back, paraphrasing it, asking open-ended questions. Can you tell me more about that? I want to understand what the issues are that you are faced in your procurement department, because I think we can help, but I want to be sure I fully understand what the issue is before I can offer a solution that we may be able to provide. That's fine. And I think people respect that. You want to hear what I have to say. You're not here just to tell me what you think I need. You're here to listen to me tell you what I need.
Yes, it's one of the strongest from the seven principles of Stephen Covey. It's a world bestseller he wrote. And it was that situation with this man and the two children in the U-Bahn. Yeah, and the kids made fun and were loud. And he told the father, what's up with your kids? And the father wakes up and said, oh, true, we were in the hospital and the mother of the children died. And I don't know what to do, but I think you are right. And Stephen don't felt so good in this moment.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, we really have to make an effort. We may never fully be able to understand what other people are thinking, what's motivating them, what problems or concerns or issues they have, but we need to make an effort.
Yeah.
And you get an awful lot of credit for making that effort. Even if I get it wrong, I might say, Christian, you sound very disappointed in not making that business deal that you were working on. And you might say, I'm not disappointed. I'm really surprised more than anything else. Okay, so I got it wrong. Mm-hmm. I said disappointment. You said surprise. What have I done? Now I've learned what it is that you are feeling mm-hmm. about what happened. So now when I respond next, I say, well, can you tell me why it surprised you? Was this something you didn't expect? All of these things, when you do them almost unconsciously, if you've been negotiating a long time, convey to the other person, I'm interested. I want to know. I want to get it right, and you're patient and thoughtful. Instead of just telling people what they need, you know, it's you go in to buy a new car, and the salesman may say, oh, Christian, I know exactly what you need. I got this brand new car, boom, boom. Well, he doesn't know you, and he doesn't know what you need. The smarter salesman is going to say, hey, how can I help you today? What sort of transportation are you looking for? And why don't you take your time, look around? I'm going to be sitting over there, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have, but I don't want to be over your shoulder and bothering you and putting pressure on you. That's a salesperson that I'm probably going to give my business to mm-hmm. rather than the guy that's following you around in the showroom and he's asking you a million questions and pretending like he knows about your life and what you need. I think some salesmen think that's the way to go, but in my preference, it's not.
It's often too much.
Yes. Yeah? Wait, that's a good way of expressing it, I think. It's too much. It's like the art of being a really good waiter at a really nice restaurant. You want them to be there when you need them, but you don't want them to disturb you when you don't need them. And I think the really good waiters, without even being conscious of it, can do a good job of gauging the mood, the conversation, the behavior. When's the right time to say, would you like to order some dessert now? Or when do you need a new drink? Versus just constantly interrupting and bothering. It can be, as you say, too much.
Yeah, and in this fast world, it's very, very difficult for many people being a good waiter.
Yeah.
But you have to.
And then there's the opposite. There's the opposite mistake of not being attentive enough. You know, not looking over at the table and the guy saying, hey, I want my drink refilled or whatever it is. I think it's a challenging balance. And I doubt anybody gets it right all the time. But I think successful individuals develop skills that allow them to have a better sense of the level of engagement that's required.
And I learned from you, it's a thing between balance and flexibility.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And I have a question because of your flexibility. So how do you deal with someone who appears completely irrational?
It's very tough. I mean, and in my former life, that was not at all an unusual occurrence. It quite frequently, actually. It requires a great deal of patience. Most importantly, it requires self-control. You have to control your own emotions and be sure that you do not overreact or attack them because their behavior is inappropriate. The things they say to you are hurtful or degrading. If you respond in kind, it's really not going to accomplish anything. So self-control, I mean, if you look at it, if you can't control your own emotions in a negotiations, how can you begin to influence someone else? You can't. So that's actually the very first thing I say to negotiators when I train law enforcement negotiators. Self-control is the first two words out of my mouth. If you can't do that, you're going to have a hard time being a successful negotiator. Mm-hmm. If you allow every bump in the road, every obstacle, every inappropriate response to cause you to anger or to say something regretful, it's really going to be an impediment to your success. You know, it doesn't mean you have to be insulted. If you and I were negotiating and you kept saying bad things about me, I might say, Christian, you know, you asked for this meeting and I'm here spending time with you today. I appreciate the fact that there's a problem. I can hear that you're very upset with our inability to provide the product and meet your expectations. But, you know, if you're yelling at me, it's really not helping us solve the problem. So can't we try to work together to see if there's some solution? Now, that doesn't guarantee that the other person will calm down. But if you continue in that vein and don't overreact, there's an old saying, it takes two to tango. It takes two people to do the dance. Mm-hmm. You know, if someone's angry and mad at you and you don't respond in kind, it tends to allow things to settle down rather than throwing fuel on the fire and making it worse. You have an effect of demonstrating the appropriate behavior for the other person to copy. You know, and there are some cases. I want to be completely candid with your listeners. There are negotiators in this world that say they guarantee results, and I can always get the outcome I want. Well, I've been doing this for, I don't know, 45 years or something. I can't guarantee those results. There are things going on in people's lives that you're unaware of. There may be decision makers at a different level who have already made up their mind. They're just talking with you because they have to get bids from three contractors. I mean, you don't know what's going on. This person's having a bad day. As the story you reflected, the children's mother just died. There's things that we can't possibly know. So the only thing you can control is yourself. But with those people that are consistently negative and angry, it's okay to walk away. It's okay to walk away. So, you know, I can tell that something I've said or this situation has got you very angry. I think maybe we should set up another call when we've had a time to think about this. Mm-hmm. Because as long as we're in that state of anxiety, we're really not going to accomplish much. And you've seen from the slides in the class, and I know your listeners can't see this, but if you imagine a teeter-totter, I don't know what you would call that in Germany. What's the name for that? A child's play equipment where one goes up and one goes...
Huh? And a vipper. It's okay, called a vipper. And a vipper.
Okay. Well, when one end is high, that's emotions.
Yeah.
The low end is rational thinking and behavior. And I would submit that you cannot accomplish anything in a state of high emotion and low rationality. So the negotiator's job is not so much to offer a better deal, a clearer set of particulars, but rather to concentrate on lowering the emotion. And when we lower the emotional level of the exchange, what comes up as the vipper's emotion comes down, the other party's ability to think and behave more rationally increases. It's a very simple principle, but it's key to everything, not just in business negotiations, but in life, in my opinion. It's really, if you're mad at your spouse, sometimes before you say something you're going to regret, maybe it's best that you step away a little bit and cool off and think more carefully before you make a bad situation worse. And it's amazing. I don't know you, I can think of many instances in my life where something has happened and my initial reaction is, oh my God, this is terrible. The next day, yeah, not so bad. We'll figure it out. When my son was young, he wrecked the car and you see the car and you go, oh my God, my God. And then you say, wait a minute, he's safe. Nobody was hurt. It's just a car. It's no big deal. But your initial reaction is in that high emotional state, right? So then when that has had time to subside, now you think about it more rationally. You say, like, well, it's not that bad. I've got insurance. He's not hurt. That's the important thing. Nobody else was hurt. Yeah, life goes on. It's okay.
Yeah, and let me paraphrase it. And again, it's all about balance, flexibility, and to be a good waiter.
Yeah, I think so. No, I think
Yeah.
that's right. A lot, I have a whole presentation, as you may recall, on how you say it. And I think there's a fair amount of research that shows that a very high percentage of what we say is more focused on the manner we say it versus how what we say. Don't ever underestimate the power of your tone and your demeanor. And of course, this goes to, in the business, your facial expressions and your body language. So I look through the camera now as we're recording this, and I see a face, and we've met before and we're friends, but I see you smiling and engaged. And that's positive. And it helps fuel a good discussion. We're comfortable. There's no aggression. There's no caution on our parts that what's he trying to do? Why is he asking me that? What's his angle? Is he trying to, argue with me? If we can get away from all of that and just say, I like this person. The number one attribute of successful negotiations in all the work I've done is likability. Now, that might be defined differently by different folks. What is it? Well, I think it's a lot of unknowns and it's slightly different from one person to another. But if you are a likable, engaging, empathic person, you'll be successful in life no matter what you do, no matter what your business, because people want to work with people they like and appreciate and respect.
Many of my listeners are familiar with the Harvard approach to negotiation: structured, interest-based, and rational. How would you describe the DNA of the FBI negotiation approach in contrast?
Well, you made a comment in your opening remarks. I don't know that you meant it that way, but the FBI never copied Harvard's program. They evolved separately and after us. But I'm not an expert on the Harvard approach because it's so oriented towards business, in my opinion, of what little I know about it. But I think our DNA started out, as we learned from NYPD in 1973, New York City started negotiations, and the FBI started in 74. It was about bargaining. It was about isolating a perpetrator, bad guy, in the spot where the crime was being committed, so they could not spread that crime further or endanger more lives. So we isolate it, and we, instead of charging in with guns or demanding they surrender, we open a dialogue. And again, I go back to the teeter-totter that, through the discussion with the police officers, they come to realize they don't have as much power and control. Hostage takers say, I've got a hostage. If you don't do what I want, I'll kill him. I control everything. Well, they don't really want to kill the hostage because they came to get money, they came to get jewelry, they came to whatever their demands are. they're not there to kill that person, and they're threatening that person. And when they do that, it tells me they want to live. For example, if I'm a hostage taker and I say, Christian, if you please come in here, I will kill this hostage. Now, many police officers hear that and they go, oh my God, he's going to kill a hostage. I hear that and I say, he's scared to die. He doesn't want to die. He's threatening this person to keep me away. He is scared of me. I control him. I'm the only one that can keep him safe and alive. Now, he doesn't realize it right now, but after we talk for a while and he sees that I don't just do anything he says when he snaps his fingers, I make him work for everything he gets. If he wants food, he's got to give me a hostage. Eventually, he's going to see that he's left with two choices: cooperate with the police or maybe die. That's my choices. And for us, in a very high percentage, they want to live. And we have to help them find a way to reach that conclusion, but we success. Now, businesses, so that was the model we started at. And then, as I mentioned earlier, in 1990, we shifted to a crisis intervention model because we found that in the United States, and I will tell you the world over, Germany, all of Europe, Canada, Australia, what police are really responding to are not hostage situations. They're crisis intervention, drug, alcohol dependency, domestic man and wife angry, somebody's mad at his boss because he got fired from a job, all of these things where the person is acting irrationally, is acting on emotion. You know, if you kill your boss, you're not going to get your job back. That makes sense, but that person is not in that clear thinking mode. So that's our DNA is diffuse, lower emotions, stall for time, the name of my book, because time allows us to make better decisions, allows for more clear thinking, lowers tension, allows us to bring in more resources. It does a lot of things for us. Time alone is a great thing to have. So when some police commanders say, this is taking so long, you say, well, it's good. Nobody's getting hurt. Time is a little bit of money, but it's lives at line. So that's, I think, the major difference between the business negotiations. We do have a team structure and work as a team. I think the Harvard approach, it's preparation, it's developing a plan, it's having an alternative and knowing when to walk away and all that kind of stuff. And in my world, I couldn't walk away. I didn't have that option. And although I believe in a win-win, you could say that in law enforcement, we win, the bad guy loses. But I've always felt that when a bad guy surrenders instead of being killed, then he wins too. So I still call it a win-win. So I'm not sure if that addressed your question, but.
I think the question is, one of your pupils were Chris Voss, and he fires against the Harvard concept. And in my opinion, there are two schools: the FBI school, let's name it like this, and the Harvard school. And the Harvard school needs these great things from your behavioral change stairway model to make better decisions and to get better goals. And on the other hand, in a hostage situation, yes, you can't argument with a business speech from Harvard. But on the other side, it's possible and it's helpful to take these tools you were teaching.
I mean, this will sound self-serving, but I think the business community can use more of our tools than the other way around. It's not to suggest that there's not some value in the approaches to business that are very helpful. But by and large, we're really dealing with a different set of circumstances. I mean, when General Motors is negotiating with Mercedes, they don't kill Mercedes if the deal goes bad, I mean, it's both parties are incentivized to have a successful outcome. And I think it's quite evident that in law enforcement, it's a different dynamic. We're not looking for a long-term relationship. We're not looking to increase business. We're looking to keep people alive and to resolve without anyone getting hurt. So again, I would never suggest that the negotiation, law enforcement negotiations couldn't benefit from some things in business, but I think primarily it's the other way around right now. I remember many years ago, back in the 80s, I had a one of the professors from Harvard called me up at the FBI Academy and he said, you guys, everything you do, you learn from us. And I said, I've never heard of you. I don't even know what you're talking about, sir. But, because it worked in the business community, he assumed wrongly that we were applying those same skill sets in law enforcement. And frankly, we just weren't. It's a different kettle of fish, Now, if I was trying to negotiate a big contract, I would go to an experienced, I would go to Andreas, or I'd go to you and say, hey, I've never done this. Help me, because it's not my area of expertise. But if someone's holding your son or daughter hostage on a when they're on a trip to out overseas, then you might want to be in contact with someone like me. So
Yes, for sure. Okay, yeah, okay. That's a point. Gary, for our listeners, can you share a situation where everything was truly on the edge? And what was the most critical moment? And what exactly did you say or do?
well, there's so many. I mean, the first chapter of my book talks about one that ended up not in the way we would like, but a man was holding a woman and child in a remote, I guess you could say, cabin in the rural area. And he had kidnapped her. He'd formerly lived with her. They had a child, but their relationship was long over. But he kidnapped him. And they were found in this house, and I had to go out and negotiate with him for 10 hours. And initially, it wasn't too bad, but I began to ask him, how were we going to resolve it? I tried to minimize what had happened. This is a argument between you and your former live-in wife, and no reason for anyone to get hurt, kind of the standard thing we do, and show him that he's not in that big a trouble. But he went psychologically volcanic, and he just went crazy and yelling and screaming, and he was going to kill her right then while I'm talking to him. Quite tense. And I won't go through all the details, but if somebody wants to, hear about it, they can read it in the book. But anyway, excuse me. Ultimately, I only convinced him not to kill her by letting him think he was going to be able to get to a helicopter outside and fly away. We don't let people do that. We don't let somebody get in a helicopter and take their hostage and go off to Never Never Land. I knew that, but I had to convince him we could not get to where he was quickly enough to save the woman and child. So the only way he would be vulnerable is if we brought him outside to go to the helicopter. So my negotiation for several hours was focused on convincing him that he was going to ride on that helicopter and that his scheme was going to work. And that was extraordinarily challenging, and ultimately, he did bring them out of the house, and an FBI marksman was able to take his life to save the woman and child. Now, someone might say, why did you put that in a book about negotiations? Well, he would have never come out of the house had I not created a relationship of trust with him. Now, despite that relationship of trust, he kept reminding me that if this didn't happen, he was going to kill her, and I believed him. But it's a tough situation. And the problem is in law enforcement, if we make a mistake, it's a fatal mistake. It's not like, oh, we lost the business. Too bad. We'll get another client. No, it doesn't work that way in my former life. It's life and death. If somebody dies, they die. And that weighs heavily on your performance and your decision making and your actions. But so that's a pretty dramatic case. And, so in my mind, I say he made the decision. He made the decision about the outcome. I didn't make the decision. He decided that this is going to happen or he's going to kill them. I facilitated it in a way that made him feel he could do that. Does that make me a bad person? I mean, I don't think so. There's a woman and child alive today because of that. It's funny, I'm still in contact with her too after,
Ah, cool.
many, 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 many years. And she's doing well. But that's an example of the kinds of things we do. And I don't like manipulation. I don't, although we kind of did on that one, I generally avoid that. I don't like lying to perpetrators. I have found success in creating a relationship of honesty and openness. And when they ask you something that's really crazy, you say, I can't do that. There's a lot of things I can do for you, but I can't do that. The other thing we have that may have a business relationship is we always project that negotiators have limited authority. And this is important. So if you and I are negotiating and you say, I want one, two, three, I may say, okay, I hear what you're saying. Let me understand. You want number one, you want number two, and this is what it is. You want number three. Let me present that to my boss, the decision maker, and I'll see what response he or she has. Now, this allows us time to analyze those demands to determine what's the best way to respond. That has some parallel to the business community. It's okay to take a time out. It's okay to say, you know, we've really raised some very challenging issues here. I'm not authorized to make a firm decision on it now, but let me go back and talk to my team, see what our executive CEO feels about this. Let's meet again tomorrow or the day after, whatever it might be. Slowing things down like that, again, can be a valuable tool for you to use.
It's very, very important. This take your time and
Yeah.
maybe take a timeout. It's very, very important
Yeah.
also in B2B negotiations. So I don't know if you would like to answer the following question, but in my opinion, there are not so much greater things to learn from other mistakes. And so looking back, what was your biggest mistake and what you learned from it?
Well, I would say it's more of an institutional mistake, and that's the famous Waco incident from 1993. You know, 51 days, a religious zealot, a very controlling, manipulative, narcissistic individual, and his faithful followers. And you know, it began with another federal agency trying to do a search warrant and an arrest warrant over firearms violations. A shootout ensued, and four ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agents were killed, 17 wounded, and five or six cult members were killed. So now they call in the FBI and say, resolve it. Well, you don't want to start a negotiation with, you know, it's a very uncomfortable spot to begin.
Yeah.
You can imagine the level of emotion and anger and frustration. You can't very well come and say, hey, I'm Gary with the FBI, let's be friends. You know, it's not so easy. So it took a great deal of time to reestablish a connection. My negotiation team that I headed, we slowly began to get people out, but it was quite an expensive operation, $1 million a day in 1993. There was a lot of public pressure and sentiment against these people, pressure on the FBI to just go in and get them. Just they killed federal agents. Go kill them. That's what you do, FBI. And there were even leadership people in the FBI that wondered why is negotiations taking so long, you know? And again, I had to fight that argument. Patience, take our time. There's ups and downs. When you plot a negotiation, it's not always headed in the right direction. Sometimes you go up, then you go down a little bit, then you go up again, then you go down. It's volatile based on human behavior. Well, we finally ran into conflict between the tactical command, you know, the tactical people, the tactical team, and the negotiation team. And there was a different philosophy. We wanted to talk them out. The tactical team wanted to force them out. So we would negotiate someone out, and then they would go forward with a tank and they would crush a car or do something sort of controversial. And this caused problems for us, and then take a couple of days to get back on track with negotiations. And the problem, we had a very volatile on-scene commander who didn't understand that we were sending mixed signals, despite being told. He said, well, you guys do your thing, they do their thing. I said, you don't understand. You know, we have to think, we have to say and do the same thing. I was relieved halfway through because I was viewed as an impediment to strong tactical action. And I was guilty as charged. But during my time, we got 35 people out, including 21 children. For the remaining 25 days after I left, they didn't get another person out at all. No one. And the FBI decided to put in tear gas. The Davidians started a fire, and over 70 people died. Now, there was a ton of lessons to be learned in that incident. And it was more a departure of what we knew how to do. We had done major prison riots before, major sieges, but in this case, we had bad leadership. So we implemented changes to make sure that didn't happen again in the FBI. The on-scene commander and the tactical leader were encouraged to retire, and I was given a promotion. So the FBI defended itself publicly, but it was clear within that we knew we had departed from our typical procedures. So that remains to this day. I mean, that's a case that just doesn't go away. I get asked about that every week. I've stopped doing interviews on it recently, but enough's enough. But it's a huge case, and it's a big historical event that gets raised all the time in America.
We can see this also as documentary on Netflix in Germany.
Yeah.
And yeah, big, big case. Oh my gosh. Let's thank you so much. Let's start our closing round. Three
Sure.
questions, and
Okay.
you have to end the sentence, please. And the first is, negotiation in one sentence is
Patience.
oh, one word. Okay.
Oh,
Yes,
I have a
thank you.
sentence?
Yes, okay, that's good.
Yeah, I said being patient.
Yeah, okay. The biggest illusion about negotiation is.
The biggest illusion about negotiations is that never give the other person anything without getting something back. And if I can explain, making small concessions does not necessarily have us lose control or power. It
Small.
demonstrates, yeah, it demonstrates that we're, yeah, small. Now, they say I want $1 million in gold bullion. You don't say, okay, here's $1 million in gold bullion. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, if the guy wants, you're talking to a guy that's going to kill his wife and he wants a cigarette, you might give him a cigarette. That's a, and it, I do that because I want to show him that I'm not there to make his day worse. I'm there to try to help him. But many in the negotiation business, they give nothing unless they get something else up. So that's,
Yes, and that's a problem.
yeah,
So
I think
if
so.
it's all about relationship and it's not bargaining, then it's a problem.
Precisely.
Okay. And the last question of this evening in Germany this evening. The most important thing people should understand about emotions is.
I think when people are operating in a high emotional state, they are unable to think and behave rationally. So the first, as I mentioned earlier, the first and most important task in negotiations is to first work towards lowering the emotions. Nothing positive can happen. If we're yelling and screaming at each other, nothing positive will ever happen.
Yeah. Thank you very much. It was such a great pleasure and
My pleasure.
also a great honor. I hope all the listeners hear what you say and all they would buy your book, Stalling for Time. It's a great book. I read it 2 times and I got your
There
sign in it.
you
And
go.
so thank you again very much.
Well, it's my pleasure to be on the program with you, and I wish you great success with the podcast series, and hopefully people will find some value in our discussion.
Das war das Interview mit Gary Nesner und ich hoffe, ihr hattet ganz viel Freude daran.